Welcome to Module 6. In Module 6, we will discuss data protection. And we will look at the data protection from two different perspectives. First of all, we will talk about the concurrency aspects of protecting the consistency of your data. What happens when multiple sessions want to access and update the same row or the same set of data? Then we will talk about security. So we will talk about data protection in terms of protecting unauthorized access to your data and providing your users with the right permissions to various pieces of your database and various features of the database engine. We will also discuss auditing features that are available to monitor any database activity and actions performed by your users inside the database engine. So let's start by discussing concurrency. Concurrency and consistency. Concurrency and consistency are actually mutually opposing goals. You cannot provide a high level of concurrency while maintaining a high level of consistency. You will probably have to sacrifice one or the other. You cannot have multiple users modifying the same data at the same time and at the same time make sure that the data is consistent. So you have to be aware of the various things that may happen inside the database. You know, busy relational databases are interesting places, and there are things that happen there that you should be aware of. So we will look at the various aspects of how we could protect and prevent so-called concurrency phenomena from happening. So all the things that can happen while multiple users and multiple transactions are accessing and modifying the data. Let's take a look at some of the things that can happen inside your database and how we can prevent them. First of all, the possibility is of performing a dirty read. A dirty read is when you read the data that was modified by another transaction before it was committed. That issue can only happen in the read uncommitted transaction isolation level. So in the lowest isolation level that is available in SQL Server. The other isolation levels prevent those by placing locks. Non-repeatable read is when you read the same data twice and you see different values. So, for instance, you reread the row and the value in the row is different because it has been modified in the meantime. And that can also happen in the read committed isolation level. Repeatable read and serializable isolation levels do prevent this from happening by holding the locks on any data that you read for the duration of your transaction. And then finally, the phantom read. A phantom read is when you read a range of values, and while you read the range of values and you reread the same range later, you see more rows. So you have another row appearing within the, your range of interest. That can happen in any isolation level with exception of serializable. Serializable prevents this by locking ranges of data rather than the actual rows that happen to be in those ranges. So SQL Server provides us with four isolation levels, four so-called pessimistic isolation levels. So pessimistic concurrency model is based on locking. We prevent things from happening by placing clocks against any data that we read. That, of course, limits the concurrency. So by placing those locks, we have better consistency. We prevent those unwanted issues from happening. But unfortunately, we also limit concurrency because we will be blocking other transactions and we will be blocking other processes from accessing or modifying the same data. The four isolation levels that are available in SQL Server under pessimistic isolation model are read uncommitted, read committed, repeatable read, and then finally serializable. With, of course, the read uncommitted being less restrictive and serializable being most restrictive isolation level. In addition to those pessimistic models based on blocking and locking, SQL Server also implements optimistic concurrency model. And in the optimistic concurrency model, we do not prevent certain things from happening. We allow operations to happen simultaneously. We serve previously committed versions of the rows using versioning. So it's similar to the Oracle isolation levels. But we do detect any conflicts that might be occurring between in transactions that are running in the optimistic isolation levels. Now, SQL Server provides two versions of optimistic isolation levels. One of them is snapshot isolation. Snapshot isolation basically makes your transaction run as if it was run against a snapshot of a database. So you don't see any concurrent changes within your database as you run your transaction. All the changes are not visible from the point of view of your transaction. As long as your transaction is running, you see exactly the database state that was at the beginning of your transaction. Only until you commit your transaction, you will see any changes that happened in the meantime. That isolation level requires you to change the application code, because the application code has to request the snapshot isolation level, and it has to be prepared to handle any potential conflicts with other updates that are happening concurrently. Another optimistic isolation level is the optimistic implementation of the default read-committed isolation level. And the read-committed, so-called read-committed snapshot isolation level, it's just another flavor of read-committed, and it allows your application to take advantage of it without any code changes. So any application that takes advantage of the read-committed isolation level can take advantage of the read-committed snapshot isolation level if it's enabled on the database by the DBA. That way, you can remove reader-writer blocking within the database. So under pessimistic isolation levels, any writer or any data modification would block reads to the same data, with the exception, of course, of read uncommitted isolation level. When you have snapshot or read committed snapshot isolation levels, you remove this blocking by providing readers with previously committed kind of stale versions of the data. So they get consistent committed versions of the rows. However, this may not be the most recent values. So SQL Server has four pessimistic isolation levels and two optimistic isolation levels. And it's your choice as a DBA and as a database developer to choose which isolation level is the most appropriate for your application. Of course, each of those isolation levels and each of those models has its advantages and disadvantages. In pessimistic isolation level, we use locking to prevent changes from happening simultaneously to the same data. So as the name suggests, in pessimistic model, we do assume that there will be concurrent changes and there will be conflicts in accessing the data, and we prevent them by placing locks. In Oracle, you have row-level locks and table-level locks. SQL Server log granularity is somewhat more complicated, because you have row locks You can also have page locks, and those row locks and page locks can also get escalated to either a table level or a partition level, depending on how your data is organized. If you have partition table, your lock escalation is to the partition level, and if the table is not partitioned, then you will be locking the entire table. So SQL Server performs automatic lock escalation depending on what is happening within the database engine. If your query holds too many locks against a single object, in order to conserve resources, SQL Server will escalate individual row locks into an appropriate partition or table lock. You can also control locking by using explicit locking hints in SQL Server. So by using locking hints, you can change the behavior of the engine when it comes to locking against different objects. So either you can actually customize the isolation level with regards to each individual object in your database in your query. So for instance, I can treat one table in my query using read committed isolation level and another using read uncommitted, and yet another maybe using repeatable read. Everything depends on what it is that you need, and there is a number of locking hints that allow you to modify and affect the default behavior when it comes to locking inside your databases. Let me show you a demonstration of various isolation level behaviors. I will create conflicting updates, update and a read that conflict with one another, and I will run them under three different isolation levels to show you how various situation behave. So let's start by setting my isolation level to read uncommitted. That is the lowest isolation level available in SQL Server. I'm going to begin a transaction and read data from a particular row, and the last name is Armstrong. So this is the value that I see for a person with business entity ID 369. Now, in another session, I will begin a transaction and update the same row, changing the name from Armstrong to Doe. As you can see, my update completed successfully. There was no blocking because my other session is not actually holding any locks against this data. But in the first session, if I reread the data, I now get the value of Doe. Not only I get different values for two reads performed within a single transaction, but in the second read, I actually saw an uncommitted value. So I am now reading inconsistent data. I am seeing value of Doe that was never committed by my second session. So if my session rolls back, I get the value of Armstrong again. So this is an example of a situation where I've seen a data that was never really committed. And that is the behavior of the read uncommitted isolation level. Let's now change that to read committed, which is the default behavior. This is the default isolation level in SQL Server. If I begin my transaction, read the same row, I of course see the value of Armstrong. Now in my second session, I start the transaction and perform the update. If I try to reread the same row from my first transaction, I will actually get blocked. This read will now wait until the other session commits or rollbacks the transaction. So I have a blocking situation. This is an example of how concurrency and consistency don't go well together. So in this case, in order to ensure consistency of my data, I had to sacrifice some concurrency. Now my session is blocked and it will remain blocked for as long as the transaction on session 2 is open. So let's roll back that transaction and allow my session 1 to continue. And as you can see, I got the value of Armstrong. So I got the original value that was and that was there, and the value that was there after session two transaction rolled back. Let's now change that to read committed. Actually, one more time. Let me show you something else here. If I begin my transaction and read this data and perform the update on the second session, this read gets blocked. So let me show you exactly what locks are being held. There is a sysdmtranlocks DMV that allows you to see any locks that are currently held on your instance of SQL Server. There's a number of different locks on different levels, from database to individual keys. And we can see that there is a lock from session 51. It's a shared lock. Shared lock is issued when you want to read the data against a key. This is the hash key, the key hash, in a particular allocation unit. And that lock request is waiting. It is waiting because there is another lock that is already being held in exclusive mode against the same data, the same key hash in the same allocation unit. So this is my transaction in session 53. And as long as the transaction is running, I have the exclusive lock against that particular row. So the other session is blocked out. And depending on how long my session takes, my session two transaction takes, that blocking can take a very long time. There is no default lock timeout in SQL Server. So SQL Server will, on your session, your lock request will wait essentially forever unless you kill or roll back the transaction. So now let's change this to a snapshot isolation level. In snapshot isolation level, I get data, I get consistent data based on versioning. So when I begin my transaction, that essentially freezes my view of the database in time. For the duration of this transaction, I will see the data, but the transaction did not start in snapshot, oops. Sorry, I have to roll back here, or yeah, that will work now. I did not commit the previous transaction. So now I'm reading a transaction in the snapshot isolation level, and that freezes my view of the database as of the beginning of my transaction. So whatever the state of the database was when I begin my transaction, that's the state of the database that I will see as long as my transaction is running. So in my session two, I will now perform an update. So I'm performing an update, and after I change the value to DOE, in my transaction first, I can still see the old value of Armstrong. So nothing changed from the standpoint, from the point of view of my session one. If I commit my transaction here, committing the changes, my session one still sees the old value. So again, my view of the database is frozen in time. Only after I commit this transaction and come out of this transaction, I will see the new value of the data. So these were three examples of three different isolation levels, two pessimistic isolation levels, and two optimistic isolation levels, and one optimistic isolation level in SQL Server. So that allows you to customize the locking behavior and consistency and concurrency that is required for your database. Now let's talk about security within the database. The database security in both Oracle and SQL Server is implemented using logins and privileges and permissions. There is, however, a big difference between SQL Server and Oracle in that regard. Because in SQL Server, you have two-level security, and in Oracle, you really have one-level security. So when you, in Oracle, when you create a user account that grants access to the instance itself, and it grants access to the database that is hosted on that instance. So basically, because there is one database per instance, by granting access to the instance, you grant access to the database, and vice versa. So you just create a user, and that's enough. In SQL Server, because you have multiple databases per instance, there is two-level security model, where you have logins that grant you access to the server level, to the instance, and then those logins from the instance level map into users inside each individual database. So security on the instance level is based on logins, and you grant instance level permissions to logins, but then they map them to users in individual databases, and those users have permissions granted within each database. In addition to that, of course, you also have server roles. Server roles are used to group logins on the server level, on the instance level, and grant them administrative permissions. And you have database roles, which group users within databases and are used to grant permissions within a database. There are both built-in predefined roles as well as user-defined roles that you will create yourself to grant permissions for your application users. SQL Server has two types of logins. SQL Server can either use SQL logins that are similar to Oracle logins, Oracle users, where the username and the password hash are stored within the master database, and the SQL Server instance itself performs authentication of the user. Another possibility is that SQL Server can use Windows logins, where the authentication is performed by a Windows domain, and SQL Server only grants permission or authorizes a particular Windows user to connect to that database instance. So basically, you already authenticated to Windows. We already know who you are, and based on who you are and what is your security token within your Windows domain, within the Active Directory domain, you are granted access to a particular SQL Server instance. That way, when connecting to SQL Server, you don't need to type your username and password again. You have a single sign-on behavior where, based on who you are in Windows, you can connect to various database instances. SQL Server can also depend on Windows functionality for enforcing security policies when it comes to logins. Things like password complexity, password expiration, etc. Now, privileges and roles. Oracle and SQL Server both have system-level privileges and object-level privileges or permissions. So system-level privileges are permissions to perform certain actions on the system level or against any objects of a particular type. Example, alter any database in SQL Server or alter any table. These are system-level privileges. Object-level privileges are where you have permissions to individual objects. So, you know, grant select on orders to Joe, that's a object-level privilege where Joe is granted access to an individual object. SQL Server can use roles in order to simplify permission management. If you need to grant certain permission set to multiple users, it becomes much easier to create a role, group all your users within that role, and grant permissions to the role itself. Those roles essentially work like Windows groups that group your Windows accounts. There are two types of roles in SQL Server. There are server level roles that are used to group logins on the server or instance level and grant certain administrative permissions and administrative privileges to the entire instance. And there are database roles, separate in each database, that are used to group users within that database, and then grant that role permissions to various objects within that database. There are also application roles available in SQL Server, and the application roles are based on passwords that are only known to a particular application. So if you want to ensure that a user can connect to the database, but only if he's using a particular application, so he cannot perform any query or run any ad hoc statement against your database, but he needs to access the database using a particular application, then the application role can be your solution. Now let me show you how to create various types of users and logins within a SQL Server instance. So I'm going to create two types of SQL Server login. I'm going to create a Windows login, and I'm going to create a SQL Server login. Let's start by creating a SQL Server login. That one is simpler. It is more similar to the behavior you know from Oracle, where you have instance-level user account. So I'm creating a login called DBO demo with a password. And then that password hash will be stored within my master database, and that will be used to perform user authentication. The default database is indicated as AdventureWorks 2012, and I turned off password expiration and password complexity policy. So basically, the password here does not expire. The password for this login does not expire, and we are not enforcing the complexity rules for this password. So I create this login. So now the login has been created. It's a server level login. With this login, I can actually connect to the database. So if I open new query and I say that I want to connect using DBO user, DBO demo. So DBO demo user. That's the one I want to use to connect. It failed because cannot open user default database. I actually do have a login, and I know the password for it. That login should be able to connect, except the login has a default database specified, and that default database cannot be accessed by this login because we haven't given any permissions to that database yet. So the next step that we need to perform is we need to map this server level or instance level login to a user within a database. So within the AdventureWorks database, I create user that maps to that login. The name is the same, but one is a user within the database and the other one is a server level login. I can also now within the database add this user to a database database role, and the database role is db underscore owner. It's essentially a role that grants ownership-like permissions to that user. It will be able to do anything within that database. So if I try to connect now, no problem, and I can access tables in that database. So I grant full ownership rights to this login inside that database. So it's always a two-step process, creating a login and then creating a user for that login in a specific database. Let's now do the same, but let's create a Windows login. So I'm going to open my control panel, and using administrative tools, I'm going to create a new user. So local users and groups, I'm going to create a user called Bob with password. Does not have to change password at next login. We can mark that the password never expires. So I just created a new Windows login, local Windows account on this server. I now would like to add this account as a login to SQL Server. Basically, I would like to let Bob connect to my SQL Server instance. So for that, I go to my back to my Management Studio, and in my Object Explorer, I navigate to Security, Logins. Here's all the list of all the various logins, both Windows and SQL, that are already existing, including my DBO demo login that I created just a minute ago. I will create a new login. And I can create either Windows authentication login, so basically from the Windows account, or SQL Server authentication by specifying the password. That's what I've done in the previous step. This time I will create a Windows-based login. So I'm going to specify a Bob here, and I do have a local account for user Bob. That already creates, and we can see the syntax, that already creates a login for Bob. Except, of course, Bob will not be able to access anything, access any user database using such newly created login. So what I need to do is I need to provide user mapping for this login. For login Bob, I go to user mapping and I say I want Bob to be able to access AdventureWorks database, and I'm going to simplify the username a little bit so I don't have the server name, and we will call that user just Bob inside the database. And as you can see, I'm going to mark here database owner. I'm going to make Bob a database owner in my database as well. And with that, I just created a Bob login right here, and that login has a specific user mapping for AdventureWorks. Now, I could also grant Bob membership in one of the predefined server roles. And the most important server role in SQL Server is called sysadmin. That's a server role that grants full unlimited permissions to the entire instance of SQL Server and all the databases that reside on that instance. So if Bob was our new DBA, I would grant him sysadmin permission on that instance. So in this demo, you've seen how we can create logins and map those logins to individual users inside the database. It is very important to remember that the security model in SQL Server is somewhat more complicated than that of Oracle, and that you have two-step process or two-level security model where logins provide you access to the instance, But in order to be able to use individual databases, that login must map to an appropriate user account within each database that you would like to access. Let's now talk about auditing. Auditing is available in both Oracle and in SQL Server for monitoring various activity performed by your user. So you can make sure and capture statements that are executed against individual objects, both on the instance level as well as within individual databases. SQL Server has so-called SQL audit functionality that is based on extended events tracing mechanism, and it allows you to specify which actions, both data definition language as well as data modification language, should be audited and for which users. There is a great deal of granularity available and possible to decide which actions by which users and in what context should be audited. Another possibility is, of course, to use either SQL Server Profiler or Extended Events, which are monitoring tools, and we'll be discussing those in one of the next modules, to capture various activity on the server. And if you're interested by all the selects that are executed by user Bob, for instance, you can use either SQL Server Profiler or Extended Events to capture such statements and make sure that all the activity is recorded. That's also a possibility for or solution for auditing. Also, the DDL triggers that are available in SQL Server, data definition language triggers, can be used to capture any schema modifications that are performed within your database. There is a number of ways you can filter it, and the whole mechanism is very flexible and high performant. So in this module, we've talked about the concurrency and consistency and the various isolation levels that SQL Server offers and how they compare to Oracle isolation levels. How we can balance the concurrency versus consistency needs using various isolation levels and locking keys. And we talked about security models in Oracle and in SQL Server and how logins and database users in SQL Server can be used to control access to your resources and grant permissions to different objects. Thank you very much for watching, and this module concludes the architectural part of this training, and in the next module we will start somewhat more practical administration part, and we will start with discussing SQL Server installation and configuration.